Hello, and welcome to the next episode of Transperfect Lifestyle Talks. I'm Mark Wade. I'm the global practice leader here at Transperfect. Today, I'm joined by Kelly DeMay. She is Director of ECOA Science at Clario. Kelly, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've talked before. One of the things that we talked about was rated training. And I know that that's kind of a very keen interest for you. So for some people, rated training is like a nice have. You have a different kind of more mission critical opinion. So I'm going to start from the start. Can you talk through around what it is, why we do it, what are the pitfalls of rated training?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, rated training is a near and dear to my heart. It's important in so many ways. So yeah, what is rated training? It's really training for raters or site staff on the appropriate administration and scoring of clinical scales or clinician reported outcomes. Even performance outcomes you can do rater training for. So the purpose is that it really helps to standardize how scales are being administered across raters and across sites. So making sure that all raters are administering the scales in the same way and according to the best practices for the scale, right? And it also helps to standardize the scoring practices. So making sure raters are administering the assessments, doing the interviews appropriately, but then also scoring all in the consistent same way and according to the same criteria. And it can really help to, you know, minimize bias and placebo effect as well. It teaches raters how to identify and then reduce their own biases and placebo effect. So you can probably understand now, learning a little bit more, why it's so important, right? So without rater training, you know, there can be lots of variability in the way that raters are administering or scoring assessments. So this variability in administration and scoring can really have a drastic negative impact on the data quality. It introduces noise, makes it harder to detect treatment effects, and it could even cause trial failure if these scales are really supporting the primary endpoint. So that's why you really need to make sure that the raters are all consistently, you know, administering and scoring the scales, doing it all in the same way. And that could be really why rater training is important.
So it would, like, to me, this kind of sounds obvious, but why is there not, or is there a standard, like globally standard training course for rated training? Is that possible?
Yeah, it's a great question. So for some trainings, for some scales, it can be something where the license holder, the copyright holder, they have kind of their gold standard training for an assessment. So some sponsors can take advantage of the trainings that are developed by the authors themselves or the copyright holders themselves. Some scales don't have that kind of gold standard training that's available. And so perhaps it's a rater training vendor, right, that's creating the training for these scales. So it's kind of a mixture, right? So you can often get these rater training solutions by a variety of different ways. Some of these scales have that global gold standard, but some of them don't. But even those that don't, it doesn't mean that training's not important. It's just maybe not something that was developed, right, by the author or the scale owner, but it doesn't mean that it's any less important.
Is that a situation where, though, very established pharmas, they understand that the value of rated training, they understand that there needs to be a standardization, and perhaps smaller, less familiar organizations, I'm thinking about like institutions, like universities, they sometimes don't think about the rated training. Is that where the rubber meets the road kind of thing?
Yeah. I think for some scales and for some indications, it's so well known that, you know, rater training is so key. It needs to be part of the plan, right, in the clinical trial plan, and it needs to be part of the solution. But for some, and this is very indication specific, it might not be so well known how important rater training is. And you're right. I think that knowledge of the need for rater training even varies across institutions. So some of the big pharma are very well aware that the rater right. training is so important. For others, it might be an educational piece that they need to be just maybe educated a little bit more on the importance of rater training and when it's important, because it's not always required for every scale, for every endpoint, for every study. you know, when you include raider training will really depend on a variety of different factors, not only the scale and indication, but the phase of clinical development that you're in. Are you at phase one or two or three? What endpoint is the scale supporting? Is it exploratory or is it your primary? So all of those things factor into the recommendations and the need for raider training on certain scales.
I want to come back to the TA, the therapeutic area, because I think that's important. Maybe talk to me about, I'm curious about, because I hear this all the time from sites, like the burden is enormous. The burden from everything from the new technologies they have to deploy to the burden of paper or the burden of an EDC, whatever it is. Talk to me about the burden of raider training on top of all that. Is there a burden, and is there a burden for the patients as well?
Yeah. So there can be burden on sites for training. I mean, I think, you know, we throw a lot of training at clinical trial sites now. They have so many responsibilities and burdens put onto them when they're involved in these trials. And it's not only training on the scales, it's training on all of the different technologies that they're using, right? The ECOA system or other systems. So there's lots of training that they're doing. So what you want to do is just make sure that you're keeping that in mind and keeping the burden as low as possible, right, for these sites. So perhaps that means something like accepting, you know, previous training certificates, as I mentioned, those kind of big scales that have gold standard training programs by the authors or the copyright holders, accepting those certificates instead of having them, you know, needing to do another training program, recognizing that they've already completed a training and kind of grandfathering them in if it's appropriate, potentially having different levels of training based on experience, right? So those raters that are extremely experienced in the scale and the indication and clinical trials, perhaps they have a different training path than for a rater who is less experienced in the field, less experienced with the scale. I also think the method of the rater training is important. We didn't get to that yet, but having perhaps on-demand rater training modules so that they can, you know, do the training when it's convenient for them, that it's not one point in time on one date, 1 hour that they have to be there to get the training that they need and to get their certification, but making it more flexible for them to more align with their schedule. And so we can talk about the different paths what training looks like, but that could be a way to also.
Well, let's pivot to that. That's kind of germane. So like what does the training look like? I'm thinking of like, so let's say I'm a very experienced trainer, or sorry, very experienced raider, very experienced. I've worked with so many instruments. Humans develop shorthand. And sometimes that shorthand has bad habits. You know where I'm going with this. So how do we make sure that those bad habits are removed from the process? And it's easy to say better training. It's easy to say that. But like, are there certain tools that we use that can make sure that those bad habits don't come in or they're removed? How do we do that?
Yeah. It's a good question. So you're right that, you know, different raters will have different levels of experience. You have your experienced raters and your inexperienced raters based on their years, you know, in the field and the indication, as I mentioned. And this might, you know, lead to the need to different training paths or levels of training. But it is important to keep in mind that experience does not negate the need for training, right? So just because a raider is very experienced, it doesn't mean that they don't require training for the scale for that study. And there is actually an interesting study. This is actually quite old. I think back in 2006, they did an analysis of over 1,000 raters and their rater competency on a mood disorder assessment. And they looked at clinical trial experience. They developed this rater training program. And what they found basically was that rater competency was not achieved by clinical experience alone, meaning that raters with clinical experience still improved with rater training. And even the naive raters who had participated in many training sessions would sometimes outperform the very experienced raters, but who only had one training session. So rater training improved the rater performance regardless of their past level of clinical experience. So you're right, these these bad habits can form over time, perhaps, and they might be experienced, but are they administering the scale according to the, you know, standardized way that they should be administering them? You know, standardization is key. So it, again, it goes back to all the raters needing to be doing the scale in the same way. So someone might be doing this, you know, in 20 years in their practice, but perhaps they've drifted over time into straying away from the standardized way of doing it. And we need to bring, you know, perhaps some of those raters back to the true, you know, standardized way of doing it, again, to just make sure everyone's doing it in the same way across different sites.
And that's why at the top of the this conversation, I sort of talked about the standardization, the gold standard, because in every other discipline, we get recertified. We have to go through a recertification process. But because there is no standard here, we go through that that particular developer's training that they prescribed, and this particular copyright holder's training they prescribed, and they're not really uniform. And I think that, I mean, you tell me, you're the expert here, but to me, that introduces an unnecessary risk of lack of competence. I'm not going to say incompetence, but a lack of competence. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair, or is that overly dramatic?
No, I think, yeah, if I'm interpreting what your question, what your statement is that wouldn't it be wonderful if we had one training for the same global, and as I mentioned, sometimes there are these global trainings that are the gold standard, you know, that are developed by the author or copyright holder. That's not always the case. And even if it is, sometimes there's other training programs that a site writer might go through. So you're right. Wouldn't it be wonderful? It was just one training program that, you know, all of the sites needed to take to be qualified for that assessment. I think the industry is making improvements. And as I said, kind of recognizing prior trainings and such that if someone has completed, you know, XYZ training program for this assessment, that's recognized as being acceptable, you know, for the next study, for example. So I think we're making some progress, but yes, wouldn't it be great if all of the trainings were truly standardized? Because, I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I'm on the same page. I think it would be. I think it kind of makes total sense. Mm-hmm. But I am also very aware that large pharma are much more. They're much more aware of these things, and the smaller biotechs, naturally, it might not be as much of a high priority as others. We glossed over the impact of patient burden. We didn't really dig into that, and as you well know, with our work that we currently do with CPATH, the patient is front and center, absolutely the center of everything. The FDA has made that very clear to us. Mm-hmm. What are the expectations, one, the burden on the patients, and what are the results in for them going through a rater type training?
Yeah, it's a great question. So you're right. There's so much emphasis on, you know, patient burden and the patient voice, and they are the front and center. You know, this is why we're doing these studies. So when it comes to, you know, training patients and or how this relates to rater training, I do think part of the training plan should be training, whether that's direct to patient training or training sites and raters, on how to communicate with participants, right? How are you asking them questions about their symptoms? How are you engaging them? How are you communicating the importance of their participation, the importance of the patient-reported outcomes? Because the activities and responsibilities put on patients as clinical trial participants can feel like a heavier burden to them if the importance of those responsibilities aren't communicated to them, right? So we think of burden, like patient burden, as being something maybe easily quantifiable, maybe, you know, it's the number of assessments, the travel time to the site, how long it takes them to complete PROS. But it isn't that simple, because it should also include the patient's perception. And that's something I feel like we have maybe even a bit more control over. So say two patients have the same responsibilities in the same experience in terms of daily diaries and driving to the site and having study visits, completing PROs, and a lot of these things can't be changed, right? They're the reality of the clinical trial protocol. But what can be changed is what raters can do and site staff can do, or what participant training can do, is to communicate to those patients the valuable role they play, the importance of their data, the importance of the PROs, and that itself can lessen the perceived burden, right? So if they understand why they're in the trial and why they're completing that diary every day, why they're completing these pros at the site, even though they're feeling really sick, that can really help relieve some of their burden. And I actually was at a conference last year where they had a patient panel session that was great. And the patients were reliving their, you know, stories as part of being in a clinical trial. Mm-hmm. And one patient was actually describing the daily diaries that they were assigned to do as part of the study. I think it was a sleep diary. And she said it wasn't until mid-study that it was communicated to her why she was even completing this sleep diary every day. And maybe that intervention and communication happened because her compliance was so low. Because when she was first doing this diary, she was doing it when she thought of it and wasn't really thinking much of it because she didn't really know why she was doing it. And it wasn't until the site actually explained the importance, you know, how this is actually supporting an endpoint in this trial. It's such a valuable piece of data and how it will be used. And then she realized, you know, why she was doing this diary. And then she was happy to be completing it every day, you know, and made it part of her routine. So it seems so small, but it can make such a difference for the site to communicate the importance of these, you know, of the participants' responsibilities, of the pros, of the diaries.
And some patients are terribly motivated and some patients aren't.
Yes.
You know, patients that are asymptomatic aren't very motivated, but patients are, like, I did a study once, an MS study, and they were exceptionally motivated. Mm-hmm. I mean, they got it. They knew they were driving the science forward. They knew it. But then mm-hmm. certain other ones that are, I'm thinking of some asymptomatic disease states that patients are right. Like, oh yeah, I'm supposed to fill out the diary, but I forgot to, kind of thing. So
right. I mean, yeah, you're right. There's some like intrinsic motivation that's different between, you know, these different patient populations, yeah, or the different indications. If it's more of a healthy patient population, maybe it's vaccine or something like that. There is some like intrinsic level of motivation that can be different between patients. So in any of those instances, I think it can always help to make sure that they know, you know, why they're doing what they're doing. Why are they sure. completing this diary? And yeah, that could be communicated via the site. It could be a direct to patient training, like a participant training module. And of course, you need to just make sure that whatever training you're implementing is really catered to the audience, right? So a training that you're...
That's it. Yeah, right there.
Yeah, it's going to be much different than what the training looks like to the patient. So I'm just keeping that in mind.
That's absolutely. I mean, some patients are very altruistic and they want to drive the science forward. They want to drive the therapy forward. And then there are some patients that are, you know, perhaps a bit more individually focused. You know, and they're only interested in, well, what can I get out of this, like, yeah, you know, what's going to happen for me. So mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, but that speaks to your point. The training must be personalized, as it were, as yes. much as possible. Mm-hmm. I want to pivot to something, because again, we've glossed over a couple of things that I just want to go back to, and that is the buy-in from sponsors and the buy-in from the smaller biotech companies. I'd love to speak to that, but also speak to the buy-in from copyright holders and developers, because there's different drivers here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think for some, as we mentioned, there's a little bit more education perhaps involved in making sure that, you know, it's understood why you would include rater training, what's the importance of it, right? And as I mentioned, you know, it all goes back to data quality, really. Like, and there's a report a couple years ago that from 1995 to 2001, 95% of Alzheimer's disease trials failed, right? 85% failure rate for Parkinson's disease trials. And all these trial failures can in part be attributed to the high variability rates we see in these clinical rating scales. So it's this variability that we're trying to reduce. And so it can actually, you know, reduce the patient numbers that you need at times. There's literature out there too, showing that, you know, if you're reducing that variability and your data quality is so much enhanced by doing techniques such as rater training and others, actually you need less patients, right? So it can actually be a benefit, you know, financially as well too. And so maybe that can help with some of the buy-in for some of the smaller biotechs as well.
Yeah, I mean, but the developers, is there a burden on them or an onus on them to create a standardized rater training for the particular instruments? No.
Yeah, perhaps there are some existing, as mentioned, right? And mm-hmm. So I think for those that don't exist, I mean, yeah, I think it goes to, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was just one training, you know, that that would apply to any site and any study, so that sites don't have to redo training and take this training for this study and a similar but different training for another study, but for the same scale. So, I think it could help or be important for the authors themselves or the owners themselves of these scales to emphasize the need for training. And then if they do have a training developed, then that's even better. Yeah.
Yeah. And would it impact in any way the first patient in study? Would it impact the timelines?
To include rater training?
Yeah.
Well, that will all be so specific to the situation, but in general, it shouldn't, right? So
shouldn't, okay.
Because I guess it depends on how early you're engaging, you know, the folks who will be doing the rater training or developing the rater training. I see it as very easily incorporated into the startup activities of the study. So really you just, you know, you need your final protocol, you need the scales that you're using, and then the training can be developed. So I see it as something that is that I've seen very easily incorporated into those startup activities. And you just want to make sure that, yeah, you want the rater training to be available in time for the raters to take the training, but I see it as very easily incorporated.
Okay. Because time, as you know, time
is of the essence.
Yeah, impact time is death for us.
Yeah.
Leave it on this. Last year on this. If you were to suggest, and it's your kind of your magic wand moment, if you had a magic wand, you could wave something. And I think I know the answer to this question. What would it be vis-a-vis rater training for success?
Success. Oh boy, so many things.
I'll give you 2 wishes if you need.
I guess I think in the ideal world, right, these rater trainings, as you mentioned, are low burden for the site. The whole point of these rater trainings are not to bog down sites with more training activities, with more startup activities that they need to do, but we really just want to create a scenario where data quality and data integrity at the end of your study is the best, right? And so creating a training that is, or having rater training that is interactive, that is engaging, that is focusing on the key points and not taking them, you know, a week to complete. We need to keep it low burden, but keep in mind, you know, the whole point of it, that it's the data quality at the end that we want. So I'd say that our rater training just needs to be low burden for sponsors, you know, and having them make sure that they can track training appropriately, that it's, you know, they need to make sure that all their raters are trained prior to accessing, you know, whether it's ECOA or the COA assessments. So just making it simple for sponsors, making it simple for the raters. And then, as you mentioned, making it simple for the patients, whatever training is geared towards the patients, that it's engaging, that it's thoughtful, that it's meaningful, and that it's easily digestible, all of those things. That's maybe a very long answer.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to end it there. Kelly, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Yeah. Today I was talking to Kelly DeMay from Clario. She's Director of ECOA Science. I'm Mark Wade, I'm Practice Leader at TransPerfect. Please join us for our next episode of TransPerfect LifeSite Talks. And if you want to be on the talk, DM me. Thanks a lot.